Mini-episode 800 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 800. I'm FDH managing partner Rick Morris, here today to introduce 10 big guest moments as part of our 10-year anniversary celebration on the Great American Radio Show, where nothing is off topic. This is our 800-900 spectacular, celebrating the program's 800th mini episode and our 900th overall hour of programming in addition to our huge anniversary. This is a bit different from some of our past compilation shows in that we're not singling out top guest moments because it would quite frankly be impossible. To do so would be insulting to those not included here. Athletes such as Gaylord Perry, Sean Casey, Arch Sleaster, Tommy John, or Frank or Ken Shamrock. It would be insulting to journalists such as Liz Klayman, Will Leach, Burt Randolph Sugar, Steve Sable, Teddy Atlas, Ian Eagle, Jeremy Schapp, Chip Carey, Diane Diamond, Matt Pinfield, Bob Glauber, Rebecca Jarvis, Eddie Trunk, Robert Flores, Chris Mad Dog Russo, Bill Wordy, Eric Bowling, Sam Rosen, Ellis Hennigan, or Armin Katayan. It would be insulting to pro wrestling legends such as Harley Race, Bret the Hitman Hart, Tully Blanchard, Road Warrior Animal, Joe Laurinaitis, Jim Cornette, the original Midnight Express, J.J. Dillon, Lex Luger, or Nikita Koloff. It would be insulting to musicians such as John Oates, Rick Springfield, Steve Smith, Mickey Thomas, Christopher Cross, Bobby Kimball, or John Anderson. And it would be insulting to other great American originals like Uncle Junior, Dominic Chianese, Craigslist founder Craig Newmark, Ziggy cartoonist Tom Wilson, Mad Magazine cartoonist Al Jaffe, the San Diego Chicken, or the dozens and dozens of others not even mentioned here. But we do have 10 great moments dating back through 10 wonderful years that got underway on January 14th, 2007. Here we bring you conversational clips from the following guests from all walks of life: Bob Barker, Steve Perry, Tommy Lasorda, Dan Weldon, Gilbert Gottfried, Jerry the King Waller, Lou Graham, Kenny Albert, Ernie Johnson, and Matthew Modine. Enjoy the insights from these legends who opened up about their lives in the FDH Lounge.
Down in Zanesville, that tragedy yesterday that we saw with the animals and the kind of really non-existent and shameful lack of oversight here in the state of Ohio that leads to something like this. Clearly, those are the type of issues you've been campaigning about for a couple of decades now, but the better treatment of animals, and it's just a shame that the way that the laws were not constructed here in this state, it leads to a situation like that. They get on the loose, and authorities have to do what they have to do to protect the people. It was just terrible.
Well, it was a tragedy, just as you've said, and there's some interesting sidelights to this. Well, one thing: let us hope that the enormity of this tragedy will cause the states that do not have laws or do not have adequate laws about wild animals, that they do something about it. These collectors, as this man was, he had 56 animals, 49 of them were killed. The others ended up in zoos. The enormity of this brings the attention required to do something about it and prevent something like this. Now, they're lucky that someone or several people weren't killed, because with these wild animals running all over the area, it could have happened so easily. And 25 of our 50 states have no laws regarding collecting wild animals, or inadequate laws. And those 25 states have got to do something about it, or there are going to be more animals killed and more deaths of human beings. And Ohio is one of the four worst states in the entire country, so far as animal law for wild animals, that is. Ohio, Oklahoma, and Missouri, and Nevada are the four bottom of the whole bell. And let's hope that this will cause people to start demanding protection. Because, and another thing that's interesting, this fellow, among his 56 animals, he had orangutans, he had cheetahs, and he had chimpanzees. Now, most collectors can't get their hands on them. Where did this guy get them? I know that Ed Stewart and Pat Derby of the Paws Sanctuary are going to go after it, and they're going to find out where he got them, and they're going to follow the paper trail right back to where he actually laid his hands on them. Did he buy them from a zoo? That zoo will be in trouble if he did. Did he get them from an illegal breeder? Let's hope they get him if they do. If he did, but it was just an appalling thing.
Myself and my mom were big fans of Sam Cooke also, and I understand that's something you got from your mom. And I understand that Sam Cooke was a great influence on your voice and how you went ahead with your career and how you approached singing.
So true. I remember being in my mother's Thunderbird, a little tiny Thunderbird that she owned, and we were driving around, and I just remember hearing this song coming off the dashboard, because back then radios had one speaker and they were in the center of the dash. And I just remember hearing this voice come across, and it was it was Sam Cooke, and he was singing Cupid, and the way he sang, "Draw back your bow," I just couldn't believe this guy. It's just tunnel vision kicked in on that speaker, and the whole world went away, and I was captivated in the echo, in his voice, in the music, in the track behind his voice, and the way the track sounded, and then the way the track felt, the rhythms of it, and the soul this man had in his voice just absolutely slayed me, and I was motivated, highly motivated, at that point to find out, be it ever so tiny, what part of that that I could ever feel or try to become.
You look at a situation here, certainly one would think that if you guys were to win the World Series, your best bet would be probably a scenario like 2003. You had a guy like Josh Beckett who stepped up for the Florida Marlins, and when you look at Clayton Kershaw, who is definitely going to be one of the greatest pitchers of the next decade if he stays healthy, the same kind of opportunity I think exists for you guys with him.
Well, that's very true, and we realize that, you know, this guy's got great stuff, and we're relying on him now for the big ones. See, Joe just took him away all season the right way, make sure he didn't hurt himself, and now he's ready to put him in one of the biggest games of his life.
You were able to get a ride for the Indianapolis 500. You were able to make that happen, and with that ride, to win the race, and at the very end there, with that very remarkable climax to the race, to get past J.R. Hildebrand, the man who replaced you in your previous ride, I mean, it almost seems too fantastic to believe, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the Indianapolis 500 for me was phenomenal. That's certainly a race I'm incredibly passionate about. It's one of those races where you need to be in the right situation to win. And, you know, to join my old friend Brian Herta, my old teammate, was, obviously special for me. We didn't join forces because we were friends. I think we joined, forces because we really felt very confident in one another's ability. And there was a huge amount of trust there. And, for me, he was able to give me a package to win. He collaborated with Sam Schmidt's team. And I got to tell you, right from the get-go, it just, we were very, very competitive.
Yours was really interesting here. I mean, the title alone, Rubber Balls and Liquor, is going to tell you that. Your thing here, you know, you're telling your life story here, but pretty well blended in with, your stand-up act, your trademark creativity. So talk about the process here, how that came to pass as you were putting this together, how you decided you wanted to go about doing it.
Well, first of all, like anything, just like movies get made and TV shows get made, first I got a book deal. And then after I got the book deal, I say I was happy about that until I realized, uh-oh, now I actually have to write a book. So I started writing it, and it's amazing that once it came out, the New York Times and Publishers Weekly gave it rave reviews. And a few reviews have said, at times it gets warm and touching and revealing and then quickly veers off into immature and obscene. So it's basically like talking to me in person.
Well, so it's got the authentic Gilbert Gottfried ring to it then, definitely, huh?
Yes. It's the next best thing to actually talking to me and getting annoyed like that.
This had to be very painful for you. SummerSlam 96, having to come out in the Ravens jersey to get some heat. I know there are some things you've had to do over the years to get some heat. Where does that rate on the pain scale for you?
Well, that would have to be at the very top, because you're right. A lot of times, in wrestling, we do things to intentionally anger the fans, and it's simply for one good reason. You know, in wrestling, we don't have the home field advantage. Like, you know, everybody in Cleveland loves the Browns, and whatever team comes to town, that's who you boo, whether it's the Ravens or the Steelers or Cincinnati. It's not that those are bad guys. It's just that, you know, we like our hometown favorites. Well, in wrestling, you know, the wrestlers are from all over the country. They don't have that home team advantage. So you have to do some outlandish things sometimes to make people mad at you, because you can't be in that gray area. You either want them to love you or hate you, because if they don't really care about you, they're not going to come to see you. So, yeah, I was asked to, right after the move of the Browns, I was asked to wear a Ravens jersey out to the ring, and I reluctantly agreed, and it was It angered everybody. It even angered me. It made me mad at me.
Why don't you spell it out for the listeners here on just what that journey was like, and how it did eventually catch up with you towards the latter part of Foreigner hitting it big.
Well, it was as exciting as one could ever imagine it would be. It's like to perform your music in front of packed houses and know that people are there to see and hear you and to feel the adulation as you play hit after hit. I mean as far as a musician or someone creative in the music business, it couldn't have been any better. The downside was, you know, the bus tours would be going on for over a year. You know, every now and then you'd get home for 2 days, just enough time to do your laundry, say hi and goodbye to the wife and the kids, and you're back out on the road again. And after a while, not that you come to expect the adulation, but you know, I would find myself singing the songs and the crowds reacting and my mind wandering someplace else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd still be singing with everything I had and still be very aware of what was going on around me, but as the song was being played, my mind would wander to my kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be missing them so much that I'd be mentally missing them and thinking about them while I was on stage rocking out and stuff. I think it was guilt and the inability to do anything about it that fed my addictions.
Kind of take us behind the scenes of some of what goes into the preparation for a game. Obviously, you're talking to key coaches and players from both teams, but do you catch a weekend walkthrough with either of the teams? I mean, what are some of the things that go into this behind the scenes as far as how you and your crew get ready for the game?
Well, I'll give you the basic week. We, you know, at least from my perspective, I'll start on Monday, whether it's going on the internet, reading everything there is to know about the teams we have on the upcoming Sunday. And I'll use this Sunday's Philly-Atlanta game as an example. you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm at home, or I could be on the road, obviously, doing hockey or some other event. But Monday through Thursday is the initial preparation, you know, reading articles about last week's game. On Tuesday, we'll get a packet from each team, an email, and then a FedEx packet with all of their updated notes and statistics. You know, we'll pour through the league stats as well. I basically have a pile on my desk, you know, about 4 to 6 inches thick, come Tuesday and Wednesday with all the information that I need to go through. I'll also watch a DVD of each team's previous game. So that's kind of what you do on your own Monday through Thursday. Usually we travel in either Thursday night or Friday, depending, you know, geographically where we're going. And that's myself, Daryl Johnston, Tony Siragusa, producer, director, and a couple of other production guys. And this Friday, we'll go to the Eagles practice at about 11 or 11:30 in the morning at their facility in Philly, right across from Lincoln Financial Field. We'll watch practice. We'll sit down in a conference room when practice is over. Usually talk to three or four players who we request and the head coach, and usually at least one, maybe both coordinators. In the case of the Eagles, you know, Andy Reid has a big say as far as the offense, so usually we'll talk to Andy and then Sean McDermott, the defensive coordinator. If the head coach is more of a defensive-minded guy, then we'll talk to the offensive coordinator. So we'll spend a couple of hours at the Eagles. Friday night we'll have our production dinner where we'll talk about some of the things we learned during the day. And Saturday, when the visiting team gets in, we'll go to their hotel and do the same thing. We'll sit in the conference room and talk to Mike Smith and either one or both coordinators, three or four players, and go through the same drill. Saturday night, we'll have our production meeting where, again, we go over some of the stuff that we learned over the last 36 hours. We'll look at some of the graphics and video elements that were prepared. We'll talk about the opening to the telecast and order some dinner as well. You can never forget about that. So it's really a full week, as far as the preparation, Monday through Thursday on your own, Friday and Saturday with the group. And by Saturday night, you feel like you know everything there is to know about these two teams. You know, we could be doing a game week 12 involving two teams we haven't seen before, but their fans know everything there is to know about their teams. So you really have to play catch-up on the entire season. And, once Sunday comes at 1 o'clock, you have all this information. You probably don't use 10% of it, but, it's all ready just in case, in your mind and in your notes. And, then once the game starts, you really let the game dictate. You don't want to force things in to prove that you did the work and to prove that you studied the teams. And, you know, with us, we have Moose up in the booth and Goose on the field, so it's a bit of a different type crew than most others. Tony's microphone is actually open to him all game. He's not like the typical sideline reporter where we'll throw it down for an injury report. He's a sideline analyst where he'll give his opinions on what's going on in the field. So, Moose and Goose have really developed a great chemistry over the, 6 or 7 or 8 years they've worked together. I've been with them for 4 now and rarely step on each other, rarely talk over each other, and hopefully it's entertaining to the viewers.
How much stuff comes easily in terms of building the chemistry that you guys have had for the show on TNT and also on NBA TV? How much of it has kind of come natural? How much of it comes from outside the studio kind of bonding? I think that's something people would be curious about, because that's one of the first things that comes to everybody's mind when they're talking about that show, just how great the flow is.
Well, the thing that I've always said, you can never predict chemistry. It's mm-hmm. just impossible. And TV executives have been spending lifetimes trying to do that, trying to say, if I match up this guy with this guy and these two, will that work? And it doesn't always work. And for us, it was one of those things. The first night we were ever on the air with me, Kenny, and Charles, I remember Charles coming out and we were ready to do a halftime, and he asked Kenny, he said, what are you going to say about that when we go there? And Kenny said, you'll find out. And that has been the way we've done the show ever since. I mean, it's always been a spontaneous, unrehearsed, nobody knows the questions going in. And that's what makes it work, because you get genuine reactions and you get they're just your gut reactions to what's going on. And the fact that we don't sit there and rehearse a segment before we do it, so people know what's going to happen, that just adds to it. And I think that's what resonates with the people at home, is that this is just like four guys sitting around in a living room talking hoop. Nobody's asking for permission to talk. Everybody's got an opinion. Sometimes whoever speaks loudest gets heard, and that's what's made it fun for all these years. So there was no way to predict it, but you know, just through the years as we've gone on, we have this incredible comfort level with one another. And what makes it work too is that nobody's begging for airtime. Nobody's begging for FaceTime. Nobody wants to make the show about them. They just want to make the show better, and that's what's been really the key to the success of the show.
This film itself, Merry Xmas, has been doing well with the awards. Talk about the process of that, how it's gone through.
Yeah, they thought that the short film was going to be a pilot for a series, and Dick Van Dyke suggested it while we were shooting. He said that the family should never actually physically be together, because in the film you'll see that we're all talking to each other on the phone. My sister is in China, I'm out in the desert, and Dick Van Dyke is at home, and we're all talking to each other on the phone. And he thought it'd be funny to have a series where the people are never physically in the same space, that they're always having to communicate via telephone or text message or something, you know. And I think it could be an interesting series, you know, if Dick Van Dyke wanted to come play every day. Dick Van Dyke has got more energy than a 2-year-old. You just bang two spoons together and make a tune, and he'll start dancing. You know, he'll find a reason to get up out of the chair and start shuffling around. And he's got a beautiful, smart young wife that he's, you know, been with for a few years now. She was a makeup artist, and I don't know if that's how they met, but they're a lovely couple. And it was such a pleasure and honor to work with him.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.